I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It was a close vote, but the United Nations Human Rights Council late last week endorsed the rights of lesbian, gay, and transgender people for the first time. We'll ask a top State Department official what it all means and how that came about. That's coming up. But first, to another issue with local and global implications, food. The World Bank says that since this time last year, wheat prices have more than doubled, and the price of corn, sugar, rice, and oil have skyrocketed. That means millions more people are struggling to feed their families or just going hungry. In Senegal, wife and mother Fatou Bintou Diaye told Germany's public broadcaster Deutsche Welle that she joined food protests in the streets of Dakar earlier this year.
Rice is expensive, oil is expensive, sugar is expensive. All of these price hikes are making life really difficult for us women. A kilogram of vegetables can cost 400 francs today and two or even three times as much tomorrow. Enough is enough.
The UN's top food security expert warns that shortages of food, water, and power right now mean we could see a repeat of the 2008 crisis that led to riots on three continents. The situation has brought together the agriculture secretaries and ministers from the top 20 economies in the world, the G20. They're in Paris today and tomorrow, and that's where we called David Nabarro, the United Nations Special Representative on Food Security and Nutrition. He's with us from there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Could you just clarify one thing for us? I think many people are used to talking about hunger, but now we talk about food security. What's the difference?
In fact, hunger is the outcome of a situation where people do not have the food that they need in order to be able to enjoy a full life. And in practice, that's represented as hunger. It means you're feeling hungry because you've gone without food. But because that's a subjective definition, we're now shifting to the term food security, which is having food available when you need it, being able to buy it so that it makes sure that you're properly nourished.
Give us a sense, if you would, of what the ministers hope to accomplish in this two-day meeting. What's specifically on their agenda?
Well, we've been seeing for the last 30 years that food prices were surprisingly low in most world markets. Also, there was, unfortunately, quite high levels of hunger and food insecurity. But in general, these were not catching the attention of decision makers. And these ministers who are coming together now are realizing that there's things really wrong with the world food systems, that there are still far too many hungry, many more who are malnourished, and what they want to do is to develop better policies that ensure food security for everybody.
It's my understanding that there are actually some fairly deep philosophical differences among the ministers about what's behind this crisis. For example, the French hosts say that the global food crisis can't be attributed to a simple lack of food. They attribute this to speculators and others who are taking positions on future food prices to make money, whereas the United Kingdom, among others, believe that the issue is increasing agricultural output. I presume that there are even more opinions with 20 people participating in the meeting. Do you agree that there are these philosophical differences, and can they really bridge those in 2 days?
Well, they're not so much philosophical differences. There are differences of judgment about what is behind the current rising food prices and also volatility on markets. There's also differences of opinion on what's to be done about them. The kind of issues you've identified, the basic shortage of overall food production, the problems of recent weather changes that have led to breakdowns in particularly the wheat production system that's led to rising prices, the increasing demands on food from populations that are growing and also from things like biofuel production, and then the impact of speculators who can accentuate the ups and downs of food prices. All of these are being considered, and at the same time, we're saying what needs to be done about it. And the ministers see a need to boost agricultural production, particularly in the world's poorest countries, but not by creating great big industrial farms, but by investing in production by the small farmers who basically provide about 80% of the world's food for the poor countries. And secondly, trying to make sure that trading systems work much better so that between countries and then between blocks of countries, food can move when it's needed, where it's needed. It's actually very exciting to see that these countries are coming together, taking this massive issue seriously, and are saying we'll work with the United Nations and other international organizations to get it right.
David Nabarro is the United Nations Special Representative on Food Security and Nutrition. He was kind enough to break away from the G20 gathering of agricultural ministers in Paris to join us by phone. Mr. Nabarro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It is crunch time for a deal to raise the debt ceiling. Congressional negotiators, led by Vice President Joe Biden, are meeting daily behind closed doors and say they want to reach an agreement by the end of next week. But serious differences remain. Democrats are eager to raise the debt limit as soon as possible. Republicans say they won't go along unless Democrats support a tough package of spending cuts. As NPR's David Wellner reports, there are far more demands being made right now than concessions.
To hear House Majority Leader Eric Cantor tell it, all is well in the closed-door sessions he's been taking part in to strike a deal for raising the debt ceiling. Here's Cantor earlier today.
I continue to remain optimistic that we can get some real savings. And as the Speaker has laid out, we need trillions of dollars of savings and in spending cuts, and to demonstrate to the American people that we are changing the system here.
Maryland House Democrat Chris Van Hollen has been negotiating in the same room here at the Capitol as Cantor. During a break in today's session, he insisted any deal aimed at reducing massive deficits has to be about raising tax revenues as well as cutting spending.
I mean, you've got all sorts of tax earmarks, tax pork, and that has to be gotten rid of to contribute to the deficit reduction.
Such talk of taxes amounts to fighting words for congressional Republicans. Tennessee's Lamar Alexander is the Senate Republicans' chief message man.
This discussion that Vice President Biden is leading is not about taxes. It's about spending. And no one in that meeting should get the idea that Senate Republicans are interested in new taxes.
Democrats have begun laying down their own markers for a debt ceiling deal. New York's Charles Schumer, who's the Senate Democrats' message man, said today that no deficit can be brought down if high unemployment persists.
We have a message today. Put jobs first. Deficit reduction alone is not a cure for what ails our economy. We need to spur job creation as well. The debt ceiling deal needs to deal with both.
The competing demands and lines in the sand have some lawmakers worried that the Biden-led talks may not produce a deal in time to raise the debt ceiling. Tennessee Republican Bob Corker today demanded on the Senate floor to know what that group is really up to.
All of us are being patient as they meet in private, sharing no details about what they're doing. But at the end of this week, the end of this work period, Madam President, I think it's time that they come forth to give us a status as to where they are, so that if there's other routes that ought to be taken, people have the ability to do that.
Corker's not the only senator running out of patience.
For goodness sakes, the time is over for talking behind closed doors.
That's Dick Durbin, the Senate's number two Democrat. Durbin said today it's time that a separate bipartisan debt reduction group he's been involved in for the past half year show what it's come up with.
I really appeal to all my colleagues who believe that we should come forward with this gang of six, now down to gang of five, with our proposal to let it be known. Come to the floor, talk to their colleagues. Let us break this logjam which has stopped us from bringing these ideas forward.
But Georgia Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss, who's in Durbin's gang of five, says not so fast.
He and I have a disagreement about that. That's been part of the discussion, obviously, in our group. We don't have a deal yet. And until we have a deal, nothing's agreed to.
Nothing is agreed to, and the deadline for preventing a possible default on the debt is now 6 weeks away. If there is to be a deal to raise the debt ceiling, some lawmakers now say it may take direct intervention by President Obama, just as he did earlier this year, to avert a government shutdown. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It's day three of the Wimbledon Grand Slam. Serena Williams is back. All eyes are on Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer. All English hearts are on native son Andy Murray, and some English money, too. And ears, at least some high-profile ears, are trained on noise, and it is not a joyful noise.
That's Victoria Azarenka of Belarus in a match earlier this year, wailing each time she slugs the ball over the net. At Wimbledon, her cries were measured at 95 decibels, and the head of Wimbledon is grumbling about it.
Ian Ritchie told the Daily Telegraph, "We would like to see less of it." We assume he meant he would like to hear less of it. The concern is that players concoct these noises as a weapon on the court to distract or to intimidate. For her part, Azarenka told Reuters ahead of the tournament, "I can't change it. It's part of my breathing system, and it's just natural and something I've done since I was a kid."
And back when Azarenka was a kid, a very young kid, Monica Seles was already winning titles and setting an example with her own grunts and shrieks.
In fact, the loudest measured grunt from a tennis player peaked at 105 decibels from Maria Sharapova. So we leave you with this, what you might call a tennis court conversation, Sharapova playing Victoria Azarenka. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Many school districts are reluctantly cutting staff and dropping courses in response to tighter budgets, so educators are looking for ways to save money and improve instruction at the same time. In the first of two stories, NPR's Larry Abramson reports that some schools are turning to technology as a way to do more with less.
KIPP Empowerment Academy in South Los Angeles had to make a virtue out of dire necessity. Just as this nationwide network of charter schools was opening up a new kindergarten here, the amount of state money began to dry up. Principal Mike Kerr says he saw only one way out, raising class size.
We had to cut out one whole classroom, so we went from five classes of 20 to four classes of 28.
But how do you do that without eating away at quality instruction?
Okay, so before we move to reading groups, we're going to play Zoom.
The answer, Kerr says, was technology.
So they have about two more minutes on the rug, and they're going to rotate out to the computers.
Some kindergartners are wrapping up a small group vocabulary lesson. They will switch places with kids working on computers in another corner of the room. The computer kids will sit down with their teacher and work on reading.
She also had a problem with this word. Let's look at this word. Don't shout it out. Do you see any sounds you know?
Yeah.
Oh, so this word is?
Low.
Good. And also,
the idea is to keep the feel of a small class without the cost of additional staff. When the kids are on the computers, they get help from Elizabeth Flotman. She's the school's technology consultant.
I can walk out of this classroom and work with the children in the other classroom for 5 or 10 minutes. And I feel like most of the time I can come back into the classroom and they're all engaged.
It is not easy for very young kids to learn how to work independently like this. Teacher MJ Mathis says KIPP students practice these things in the program's special summer school.
The biggest challenge for us is teaching them actually how to sit at a computer, how to use the mouse, how to enter their password. But, I mean, it literally is just another part of the curriculum. We teach them, okay, you stand up, you stand silently behind your chair, this is how we move.
In Northern California, rocket ship education has its own flavor of what's become known as blended learning, part computer, part classroom instruction. Rocket ship has three charters around San Jose. At Mateo Sheedy Elementary, kids rotate through classes the way high schoolers do. They go to the English teacher for English instruction, and they also spend 100 minutes each day here in rocket ship's computer lab. Kids log in and start work on math or reading lessons appropriate for their grade level. The reading lessons follow the pattern of most digital learning. Kids read stories and are rewarded for the right answers. Third grader Samantha Hernandez knows how it works.
Right here, if you get 100, you get to get a sticker. And if you get like an 80, you were almost there.
Are the questions hard?
Sort of. When you didn't read it good, they are hard.
Yeah.
Music tells kids it's time to leave the computer lab so the next group can come in. With up to 100 kids in the lab at any one time, it gets pretty noisy, especially when lunch is going on in another corner of the room. Rocketship admits the setup isn't ideal, but strong improvement at all three schools seems to show that something is working here. John Danner, the founder of Rocketship, says the computer lab is a place to practice fundamentals, exercises that shouldn't be taking up valuable class time.
So if you can move the basic skills to the learning lab with tutors and technology, really there aren't a lot of teachers that would say, gosh, I really miss teaching that basic skill. They'd much rather teach kids how to think.
At Rocketship, the computer lab is staffed by volunteers and members of the community. John Danner says that allows him to plow more money into other areas of instruction.
The main things that we reallocated to are higher salaries, 20% higher salaries for teachers, academic deans at every school that can work on the professional development of all the teachers at that school, and a 3-year leadership development program to make sure that the people that run our schools are excellent.
One of the upsides of having all your students online is that teachers get tons of data, reports on their students' computer work. Second grade math teacher Bailey Thompson gets regular printouts.
So this student completed 58 problems or 58 lessons in a given week here. And I know from conversations I've had with her in class that she enjoys and is engaged by the software and that she's moving forward even beyond concepts we've had in class.
There's a weak spot in the world of blended learning. Even enthusiasts will admit that software offerings are weak, especially for young students. We'll look at an unexpected gold mine in the otherwise boring world of online math in our next story. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
From school tech to summer tech, we have a love letter now to a piece of machinery that is as much a part of the season as baseball and barbecue. It is the lawnmower, and it's the latest in our series, Summer Sounds.
It's summertime!
I'm Stephen Shepard. I'm a father of two in Phoenix, Arizona, and I write the kids' music blog, ZooGlobal.com. Once I was old enough to operate machinery, I took over the weekend chore of mowing our lawn, front and back, from my dad. The sound was loud and obnoxious, but it also meant that I'd been given a little bit more responsibility, trusted to help make sure our yard looked respectable. Up and down, in straight lines, and along the curved edges of the flower beds, I would sweatily push our gas mower. Now I have a house of my own, a lawn of my own, and kids of my own. I even have a lawnmower of my own. It's electric, though, and quieter than those gas models. Not to mention a heck of a lot easier to start. It's still loud enough, ironically, to drown out other distractions. It's 45 minutes worth of meditation. It still reminds me of responsibility, though, of all the daily and weekly tasks we parents do to keep our kids somewhat unaware of just how much work goes into creating a world in which they can still be kids, to run around in the grass or maybe pull out a sprinkler to jump around in. It's what keeps me from ripping out the lawn and putting in desert landscaping. But I can't wait for my kids to start mowing the lawn, too.
That's children's music blogger Stephen Shepard of Phoenix, Arizona, and his summer sound. We'd like to hear about your favorite summer sound. Just go to npr.org and click on Contact Us, and be sure to write Summer Sounds in the subject line.
Smiling sweetly, it's so good to touch the green, green grass of home.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Learn more about the music and artists you hear on NPR and discover new music by visiting npr.org/music. There you can also hear a Tiny Desk concert or get an exclusive first listen of new music. This is NPR.